Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, summer is officially underway with the passing of Memorial Day. We had a great march here in Middletown's Memorial Day parade. And it's a time to honor the great sacrifices that our enlisted men and women have made for this country.
That's right, Mark. So many soldiers, both men and women, have paid the ultimate sacrifice with their lives and also just the long separations from their families. And now, of course, understanding the lifelong health consequences as a result of their service. We owe these soldiers and their families a huge debt of gratitude.
And the Obama administration has reiterated a commitment to providing all returning soldiers access to health care they need to get back on their feet upon returning to civilian life.
And a lot of that is going to be in the form of research that's being done in the population to help people deal with issues like PTSD and find new treatment modalities. Many healthcare centers and teaching hospitals are expanding their assistance to these returned soldiers. So the medical community will learn much and hopefully will give much to this population.
On another pressing topic, we're waiting to learn the decision from the Supreme Court on the Affordable Care Act. Hopefully we'll be hearing about that in the next week or so. And already politicians are jockeying for position on what might happen next with the health care reform law.
And whatever the Supreme Court decides, Mark, the GOP is vowing to reverse the entire act if they can. But, you know, voters seem pretty supportive of several of the provisions in the law, including that provision that allows young adults to stay on their parents' policies until the age of 26. And, of course, the whole issue of pre-existing condition, particularly if you're somebody who suffered under it, remains very front and central, I think, in a lot of people's minds.
Now, some within the Republican delegation in Congress have suggested that they'd be willing to support at least some of the popular provisions of the Affordable Care Act. But that sentiment was quickly countered by the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, who said Republicans would fight to eliminate the entire Affordable Care Act and there'd be no compromise. So still a lot of political wrangling over this issue.
A lot of politics, a lot of posturing. And meanwhile, we'll have to wait and see what the Supreme Court decides. And then we'll see what the legality of the Affordable Care Act turns out to be.
As for the health insurance industry, our guest today has done quite a lot of research on trends there. Dr. Amelia Haviland is the senior statistician with the RAND Corporation, an independent nonprofit organization that conducts research in a wide variety of disciplines regarding healthcare, offering significant scientific analysis for policy decisions.
Dr. Haviland's been analyzing the rapid growth of high-deductible insurance plans. Those are the plans that provide a lower-cost healthcare option in exchange for more upfront out-of-pocket costs. The plans are getting favor with employers as a cost-saving measure in providing healthcare coverage and with some consumers as offering more choice. Her research, though, has also shown a clear link between these plans and people sometimes foregoing necessary medical care due to cost. That wouldn't be a promising trend, Mark.
No, it really wouldn't, Margaret. She'll also share some interesting data on healthcare disparities among different ethnic groups.
And this week, FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson looks at campaign claims on the Affordable Care Act's lifelong impact on the life of a typical American woman. But no matter what the topic, you can access all of our shows by Googling CHC Radio.
And as always, if you have comments, email us at chcradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. We'll get to Dr. Amelia Haviland in just a moment. But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headlines.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with this headline news. Memorial Day has passed with some alarming statistics regarding the 1.6 million veterans from the post-9/11 wars. Nearly 50% of those vets returning from the front are applying for some kind of disability, suffering from a broad range of disfiguring and debilitating injuries, as well as a significant portion of the vet population suffering from the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder. That compares with 21% of veterans from the Gulf War. Certain members of Congress are not idly awaiting the upcoming Supreme Court decision on the legality of the Affordable Care Act. The House has two measures queuing up for a vote that would appeal parts of the act as it stands now. One bill from Majority Leader Virginia Republican Eric Cantor would repeal the law's tax on medical devices. The first bill would come before the House for vote June 4th. Some good news from the diabetes epidemic front. The Centers for Disease Control has released a report that type 2 diabetes death rates are down sharply from the late 1990s. Cardiac death down 40% among diabetics from the same population in 1998, and overall diabetic deaths are down 23%. And how does your garden grow? First Lady Michelle Obama has revealed her gardening tips and those of the experts in a book just released this week, American Grown, the story of the White House kitchen garden. It's all part of Mrs. Obama's attempts to get our nation fit, moving, and eating healthy to combat obesity. She details plans and programs for communities and local governments to get involved. I'm Marianne O'Hare with this headline news.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Amelia Haviland, Professor of Statistics and Public Policy at Carnegie Mellon University and Senior Statistician for the RAND Corporation, a nonprofit organization that seeks to improve public policy and decision-making through unbiased research and analysis. Dr. Haviland, welcome to Conversations in Healthcare.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you for inviting me to talk with you all today.
Yeah, now you're a statistician for RAND Health, and during the past few years, you've been focusing a lot of attention on their health insurance industry, specifically on the growing consumer direct insurance market, the high deductible plans that offer a lower cost option for insurance premiums, usually in conjunction with personal health savings accounts. We just read with great interest your article in Health Affairs, this month's Health Affairs, on how these plans are taking over the private insurance market. Now, you indicate they project the projected growth in popularity is poised to save around $60 billion a year in healthcare costs. Could you first describe for us what's driving the huge increase in the numbers of Americans enrolling in high deductible consumer-directed health plans, and why are they so popular with both employers and employees?
Sure. The main driving force around it is that they have lower premiums. So these plans basically trade off a higher deductible that patients face, usually earlier in the year, with a lower premium that gets taken out of people's paycheck month by month or week by week. And because of the continuing cost pressures that are imposed, because healthcare cost growth has been so steep over the last several decades, really, and that combined with the recession, mean that a lot of people are looking to plans like this to try to reduce their monthly expenses. So they've been more popular for a while with small employers, where it's typically a real challenge to offer health insurance. And so the lower premiums mean that it's more affordable for the employer and the employee. But we're seeing a lot of growth in the large employer market, where we think it's those cost pressures that are making employers offer them and making employees enroll in them.
Dr. Haviland, your findings come with a bit of a cautionary tale. You've told us about why the consumer-directed health insurance plans show the potential and the actuality of savings, but perhaps at a price, because the analysis has also shown over time that while the plans certainly do indeed lead to fewer unnecessary tests and less overuse of healthcare, many consumers with these plans also may be foregoing necessary screenings and even treatments because of the cost, which of course contributes to cost savings, but maybe also leads to a poorer health outcome. Tell us about the downside of your findings that the high deductible plans are generating.
Margaret, these plans place all the responsibility for making decisions about what care to get and what care to forego on patients. You know, these are the decisions that nobody wants to make. We don't want the government to make those decisions for us. We don't want insurance companies to make those decisions for us. And instead, what these plans do is they put all that responsibility on patients. And those are complex decisions to make. There are a number of American families who, when faced with paying their deductible, are constrained or cash constrained around it. There are huge challenges to trying to price shop in healthcare, right? So prices are not transparent. Quality is hard to get information on. That can be a great challenge for most people. And we do find that there are reductions. This is the big cautionary note in our findings, is that there are not large reductions, but moderate reductions in all six of the specific recommended preventive care that we looked at. And they weren't big, but that's the wrong direction.
So unravel it, if you will, for us. You indicate if patients have skin in the game, they're more likely to be cautious about the types of procedures and care that they access. And I think the RAND has done sort of a seminal study back in 1971, following consumers for over a decade on healthcare usage, and sort of came up with the same cautionary note So from your vantage point, what sort of policies do you believe would best address the concerns of patients putting off this necessary care?
We were really interested to compare our results to that gold standard, which is what the RAND health insurance experiment has been. Basically, all the research that's been done since then has just confirmed those findings, that when patients experience greater cost sharing, that they do cut care, but that they cut it across the board. But instead, they cut everything they can think of to cut. You know, the employers really tell us how hard it is to communicate with employees about the features of their plans and some of the details of obtaining care. I mean, the story that we tell with these plans is, as is true for all health plans now through the Affordable Care Act, but these health plans were doing it all along, is that preventive care was covered with first dollar coverage. The deductible didn't apply. Mm-hmm. And that's how they were trying to work the incentives, right? So they wanted there to be an incentive to get that care, the preventive care, because it was covered, but to have some caution about other care. And people don't understand that mm-hmm. that care is covered. Mm-hmm. There was a nice other study in Health Affairs where some researchers called people on the phone and asked them, what is your deductible cover and not cover? Mm-hmm. And people have no idea. Mm-hmm. It's just too much to keep track of about plans.
Dr. Hevland, insuring the uninsured, those tens of millions of Americans, is obviously one of the chief goals of the Affordable Care Act, but I'm particularly interested in how you foresee the consumer-directed high-deductible plans fitting into the state health insurance exchanges. In particular, is there advice that you would have for the exchanges and the states as they set them up on how they're going to educate consumers to choose wisely which type of policy?
We have been looking at that. A lot of our study focused on the employer-sponsored insurance market because it's where there's data. Nobody quite knows what's going to happen on the exchanges yet. But the thing that is clear is that if the exchanges go up, that these plans are going to be offered there. There's been support on both sides of the aisle for that, and that they're likely to be quite popular. The things that people need to consider, that it's good to consider when choosing a plan, is not just the premium. Typically, people think about the premium only once a year when they choose a plan, and then people don't think about it very much because it's taken out of their paycheck. It's something that becomes invisible. But the thing that can pop up at any time is that deductible and the out-of-pocket max. So the three things to really pay attention to are the deductible amount and whether you as a family have enough resources to cover that whole deductible if it were to come up at once. Mm-hmm. And people who've run some analyses find that there are people with different health histories for whom these plans can make sense. So there tends to be some selection that people who are healthier mm-hmm. join these plans. And the health savings accounts that's associated with these plans can be a nice savings mechanism for. But it also could be true that folks who have ongoing chronic health concerns, that these plans can be a better value if they know that they're going to have to cover their deductible every year and they can handle that.
We're speaking today with Dr. Amelia Haviland, senior statistician with the RAND Corporation, specifically RAND Health, an independent nonprofit organization that seeks to guide public policy. Dr. Haviland, you've also spent time analyzing how information technology is changing the way consumers educate themselves about real cost of healthcare procedures so they can hopefully make more informed choices. And it actually leads to more shopping around for healthcare consumers, which I imagine is leading to some of these cost savings you've been writing about. However, there's a lot of concern, as you mentioned earlier, about the lack of transparency in healthcare costs. So what's being done to address transparency, and how is technology helping? I guess the question is there an app for that? And what other ways is information technology helping with cost containment?
You know, this is a really hot topic right now. There are now, I think, three of the major health insurers who've put out an app for that, where what the app does is it gives the enrollees some kind of information about usually where providers are, mm-hmm. whether they're in the network or not, and some kind of usually rather vague information about price. And in some ways, it's only the insurers who can do that because they're negotiating the price. They're the ones who know. The other direction that states have gone is to require price transparency information to be public, where this is often at the hospital level, where they're requiring hospitals to post their prices. You know, one of the things that we found that was actually different, which relates to this from the RAND Health Insurance Experiment, is the RAND Health Insurance Experiment found, and many other studies find, that with greater cost sharing, people just cut initiating care. So they quit going to the doctor for something, but that once they went to the doctor, the costs were just the same. And we found that for the first time, that looks like it's changing, is that about two-thirds of the savings we found were for the same reason. People were initiating fewer episodes of care. But a whole third of it was because the cost within episodes of care was lower for people in these consumer-directed plans than in traditional plans, which suggests that people are more engaged once they're involved with receiving care. For the first time, we're seeing that people are managing to reduce quantity or prices, and there's a lot of complexity in there remaining to figure out, are they making the best choices? Are they making clinically sensible choices?
You know, Dr. Hevland, I would think that one of the kind of obvious places where consumers might vote differently with their feet on the basis of these plans would be in the choice to go to primary care office, to the emergency room, to the retail clinic, maybe particularly the emergency room and the retail clinic because of the obvious huge gaps in price there and the fact that prices are pre-published in the retailer convenience clinics. Have you done any research in that area, or has that been borne out in any way?
You know, it's hard for us to track the retail clinics. Rand Health has done some really great work on the retail clinics, and they are seeing a lot of growth. And it was interesting to us that when we look at emergency room care, that's the one place that we don't see much change because of exactly there are big price consequences for going to the emergency room in most cases. That was one of the places where we thought there might be some unintended consequences. We didn't get statistically significant increases in emergency room use, but that was the one place where we did see that use actually went up, which is, again, on the cautionary side.
Dr. Hevland, we've had a lot of guests on our show focused in on trying to prevent system failures and errors in the healthcare system. Now, and your team recently analyzed the impact of the Patient Safety and Quality Improvement Act of 2005, which called for more rigorous reporting of adverse medical incidents. And this year, you also published a study in the American Journal of Medical Quality on repeated patient safety events in hospitals across the country. Tell us about your most recent findings in the area of quality and patient safety and your recommendations on how healthcare organizations can reduce these medical mistakes.
One of the projects that's active right now actually comes directly out of one of President Obama's first speeches to the country where he was interested in trying to look at connecting patient safety rates with medical malpractice. And the team at RAND that I work with on this is evaluating the pilot projects that came out of his recommendations, which follows on actually some work that we were doing where we found in California that if you look over a 5-year period, that counties in California that lowered their incidences of patient safety events had fewer medical malpractice cases, which gives a different kind of incentive to mm-hmm. providers. I mean, providers absolutely want to avoid making any errors, you know, but there are lots of people involved in a hospital, and it gives hospitals a really different kind of incentive to think, well, we could lower our malpractice liability risk if we can get these numbers down, in addition to just providing, you know, a better environment for everybody. And so there's some very interesting projects going on now that have systems where they're helping hospitals in particular to set up systems that support the medical providers who are involved if there is a safety incident, because there's a real toll on those people as well. And to have the hospital talk with the patient and their family and to discuss what the error was mm-hmm. and to offer compensation up front and mm-hmm. try to take it outside of the legal system.
That certainly seems to be becoming the new cultural norm in American healthcare. Dr. Hevland, one topic that the RAND team has analyzed and investigated at length is racial and ethnic disparities in healthcare. I know you did a recent study looking at the disparity on really just a very simple issue between Hispanic and white seniors and the rates at which they receive the flu and the pneumonia vaccinations, and you still found significant variations. Tell us about that, and how does that lead to policy directives from RAND to the country's policymakers?
They are a couple of simple outcomes about flu and pneumonia vaccinations, and we were looking at the Medicare population, where there are really clear recommendations for folks over the age of 65 for getting annual flu vaccinations and getting at least one pneumonia vaccination once reaching the age of 65. And there are also real health complications for seniors that are associated with both the flu and pneumonia. And there are massive disparities for a number of Hispanic and Latino seniors in the U.S. compared with similar white seniors. There are also disparities for African American seniors, but especially for Hispanic seniors where Spanish is their preferred language and where there's not a long-standing Hispanic community around them, where there can be gaps, especially on the pneumonia vaccinations that are, 40 percentage points, something like that, just massive gaps. And so I think it suggests that we have a lot of good information about targeting areas where this is a much more serious problem than other areas. And it should help with making efforts that can really hone in on areas where these numbers need to go up.
Dr. Haviland, we'd like to ask all of our guests this final question. When you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovation, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
Oh, Rand.
Good answer.
Good for you.
There's a lot for us to learn from other places and other systems. And there's a lot for us to learn, I think, on technology from developing countries, because they're both are, there's wide coverage of good technology here in the U.S., but there also are substantial populations that have much less access to technology. And so thinking about how technology approaches are actually working in some developing countries can be also quite useful to us here.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Amelia Haviland, senior statistician at the RAND Corporation, an independent nonprofit research organization that seeks to improve public policy and decision making through unbiased research and analysis. Dr. Haviland, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations.
Thank you for having me.
Conversations on healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, Mark and Margaret, we looked at a slideshow that President Obama's campaign put together called Life of Julia. It's a cartoon drawing slideshow of a fictitious woman's life, that's Julia, from age 3 to 67, and it claims that her life would be better under Obama's policy than those of Mitt Romney. But it makes a few exaggerations when it comes to the federal health care law. It says that Julia, as a 22-year-old college student, needs surgery that is covered thanks to the healthcare law's provision that keeps her on her parents' insurance. Now, it's true that the law required insurance companies to keep children on parents' insurance up to age 26. But as a college student, Julia probably would have been covered anyway. 37 states already had similar mandates on the books, and a 2008 report from the Kaiser Family Foundation found that 18% of full-time college students lacked health insurance, so the vast majority were covered. Also, the slideshow says that Julia's maternal checkups when she's pregnant at age 31 were covered due to the health care law, but she probably would have received such coverage anyway. Julia was a full-time worker, according to this slideshow, and 85% of full-time workers have health insurance now. A 1978 federal law requires that employer-provided insurance cover pregnancy-related expenses. And that's our Fact Check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives.
When California designer and entrepreneur Mick Ebling met a well-known street artist who went by the name of Tempt, the artist was already suffering from advanced ALS. Completely paralyzed except for his eyes, Tempt never dreamed that he'd be able to create art again. Unable to speak, his brightest hope was to be able to talk with his family somehow. Ebling, raised in a family of philanthropists and entrepreneurs, became inspired to help Tempt. He formed the NotImpossibleFoundation.org and assembled a team of designers, hackers, artists, inventors, and engineers. They used only open-source science and technology. They bought inexpensive sunglasses from Venice Beach and various other parts from Home Depot. They hacked basic camera technology, mounting the camera lens on the cheap glasses to track eye movements. Within just 2 weeks, they had a simple solution to Temp's dilemma. The EyeRider, an eyeglass frame-mounted camera that tracks eye movements and allows the wearer to write, to communicate, even to create art, simply with the movement of their eye. The EyeRider was recognized by Time magazine as one of the top 50 inventions of 2010 and has gone on to inspire more sophisticated offshoots that will allow those who are paralyzed to communicate using a simple, inexpensive device. The Not Impossible Foundation, forming a team of creative thinkers to group hack a simple solution to a real patient problem, creating a meaningful device that can change their lives. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org.